afternoons or so we have been reading together C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce and talking about it. We haven't succeeded in getting very far. That's been sort of the main problem, but we did finish talking about a bishop. We ended up on page 47. Since today is the last session on this topic this week, we have some choices. We can take up, just keep on going chapter by chapter, although I'd sort of rather not do that. Lewis has some descriptive chapters coming up. Or we can take up several more of the conversations in this book. What are your preferences? There's a marvelous, it's not really a dialogue, a monologue, by a wife that we could read. That would be chapter 10. Or we could do the chapter on a mother's love. That would be chapter 11, yes. Or the section on the animal on the that grows to the back of the person. We could talk about that. Or we can talk about some of Lewis's conversations with MacDonald. What are your choices? What would you like to talk about in this session today? I suppose I ought to decide. Well, all right.
You keep focusing on the scripture.
I do. All right. Why don't we turn to chapter 10 then? Page 84. Maybe let me just say a little bit about the book. We've got a number of people who came in today and who are joining this session for the first time. The book, The Great Divorce, is not about marriage counseling. That ought to be said right off. It's Lewis's attempt to describe the choice character of life and to use a setting beyond death as a way of confronting us with the kinds of things that we do in fact do to each other and above all to ourselves here in life. And he illustrates that with a number of episodes by having us get on a bus trip that takes the people out of a gray town which is mostly full of illusions and a town of their own imagining to a town where everything is real. The reality is painful for the people who have been living with illusions, to the people who can be seen through. And he has some bright spirits engaging the ghosts who have come on the bus in conversation. And it's in this conversation that the decision or the decisions of their own life are evident. Maybe some of the more let's use one shorter example before we do the wife. Page 73, for those of you that have books, we'll take a look at that. As Lewis is talking to George MacDonald, who was a 19th century English pastor who had a great influence on him and who is sort of his guide through this country, they overhear this conversation. And it probably illustrates as well as anything what Lewis is trying to show us. The ghost's talk was like this: "Oh, my dear, I've had such a dreadful time. I don't know how I ever got here at all. I was coming with Eleanor Stone, and we'd arranged the whole thing, and we were to meet at the corner of Sink Street. I made it perfectly plain, because I knew what she was like, and if I told her once, I told her 100 times I would not meet her outside that dreadful Marjorie Banks woman's house, not after the way she treated me. That was one of the most dreadful things that happened to me. I've been dying to tell you because I felt sure you'd tell me I acted rightly. No, wait a moment, dear, till I've told you. I tried living with her when I first came, and it was all fixed up. She was to do the cooking, and I was to look after the house, and I did think I was going to be comfortable after all I'd been through, but she turned out to be so changed, absolutely selfish, not a particle of sympathy for anyone but herself, and as I once said to her, I do think I'm entitled to a little consideration, because you at least lived out your time, but I oughtn't to have been here for years and years yet. But of course I'm forgetting, you don't know I was murdered, simply murdered. Dear, that man should never have operated. I thought I'd be alive today, and they simply starved me in that dreadful nursing home, and no one ever came near me, and the shrill, monotonous whine died away as the speaker, still accompanied by the bright patience at her side, moved out of hearing. "What troubles you, son?" asked my teacher. "I'm troubled, sir," said I, "because that unhappy creature doesn't seem to me to be the sort of soul that ought to be even in danger of damnation. She isn't wicked. She's only a silly, garrulous old woman who has got into the habit of grumbling, and one feels that a little kindness and rest and change would put her all right. That is what she once was. That is maybe what she still is. If so, she certainly will be cured. But the whole question is whether she is now a grumbler. I should have thought there was no doubt about that." "Aye, but you misunderstand me. The question is whether she is a grumbler or only a grumble. If there is a real woman, even the least trace of one, still there inside the grumbling, it can be brought to life again. If there's one wee spark under all those ashes, we'll blow it till the whole pile is red and clear. But if there's nothing but ashes, we'll not go on blowing them in our eyes forever. They must be swept up. But how can there be a grumble without a grumbler? Ah, the whole difficulty of understanding hell is that the thing to be understood is so nearly nothing. But you'll have had experiences. It begins with a grumbling mood and yourself still distinct from it, perhaps criticizing it. And yourself in a dark hour may will that mood, even embrace it. You can repent and come out of it again, but there may come a day when you can do that no longer. Then there will be no you left to criticize the mood, not even to enjoy it, just the grumble itself going on forever like a machine." Well, I guess that's Lewis's point, or one of them at least, and we see it in this phrase here that hell is nearly nothing, but that does not mean that it does not have power. And the thing he's trying to show in all these choices, is what must be rejected. That is, there is no experience of heaven, he says, without laying aside the things that we experience as hell. With that sort of introduction and background, let's turn to page 84 then, to number 10. I'm looking around for Gretchen. Where is Gretchen? Do you want to read the woman? All right. Start us off then. This conversation also we overheard. But if you have forgiven him, surely...
I forgive him as a Christian, but there are some things that you never forget.
But I don't understand.
Oh, exactly. You never did. You always thought Robert could do no wrong. I know. Please don't interrupt for one moment. You have a faint conception of what I went through.
Excuse me. Gretchen, you're dropping your voice at the end of your
sentence. Oh, sorry.
A little too long. All right.
Please don't interrupt for one moment. You haven't the faintest conception of what I went through with your dear Robert. The ingratitude. It was I who made a man of him, sacrificed my whole life to him. And what was my reward? Absolute, utter selfishness. No, but listen. He was pottering on along about 600 a year when I married him. Mark my words, Hilda, he'd have been in that position to this day, to the day of his death, if he hadn't been for me. It was I who had to drive him every step of the way. He hadn't a spark of ambition. It was like trying to lift a sack of coal. I had to positively nag him to take on that extra work in the other department, though it really was the beginning of everything for him. The laziness of men. He said, if you please, he couldn't work more than 13 hours a day, as if I weren't working far longer. For my day's work wasn't over when his was. I had to keep him going all evening, to understand what I mean. If he'd had his way, he'd have just sat in an armchair and sulked when dinner was over. It was I who had to draw him out of himself and brighten him up and make conversation, with no help from him, of course. Sometimes he didn't even listen. As I said to him, I should have thought good manners if nothing else. He seems to have forgotten that I was a lady, even if I had married him. And all the time I was working my fingers to the bone for him, without the slightest appreciation. I used to spend simply hours arranging flowers to make that pokey little house look nice. And instead of thanking me, what do you think he said? Said he wished I wouldn't fill up the writing desk with them when he wanted to use it. And there was a perfectly frightful fuss one evening because I spilled one of the vases over some papers of his. It was all nonsense, really, because they weren't anything to do with his work. He had some silly idea of writing a book in those days, as if he could. I cured him of that in the end. No, Hilda, you must listen to me. The trouble I went to entertaining. Robert's idea was that he'd just slink off by himself every now and then to see what he called his old friends and leave me to amuse myself. But I knew from the first that those friends were doing him no good. No, Robert, your friends are now mine. It is my duty to have them here, however tired I am and however little we can afford. You'd have thought that would have been enough. But they did come for a bit. That is where I had to use a certain amount of tact. A woman who has her wits about her can always drop in a word here and there. I wanted Robert to see them against a different background. They weren't quite at their ease somehow in my drawing room, nor at their best. I couldn't help laughing sometimes. Of course, Robert was uncomfortable while the treatment was going on, but it was all for his own good in the end. None of that set were friends of his any longer by the end of the first year. And then he got the new job, a great step up. But what did he think? Instead of realizing that we now had a chance to spread out a bit, all he said was, well now, for God's sake, let's have some peace. That nearly finished me. I nearly gave him up altogether, but I knew my duty. I have always done my duty. You can't believe the work I had getting him to agree to a bigger house and then finding a house. I wouldn't have grudged you one scrap if only he'd taken it in the right spirit, if only he'd seen the fun of it all. If he'd been a different sort of man, it would have been fun meeting him on the doorstep as he came back from the office and saying, come on, Bob, it's no time for dinner tonight. I've just heard of a house out near Watford, and I've got the keys and we can get there and back by 1 o'clock. But with him, it was perfect misery, Hilda. For by this time, your wonderful Robert was turning into the sort of man who cares about nothing but food. Well, I got him into the new house at last. Yes, I know. It was a little more than we could really afford at the moment. But all sorts of things were opening out before him. And, of course, I began to entertain properly. No more of his sort of friends, thank you. I was doing it all for his sake. Every useful friend he ever made was due to me. Naturally, I had to dress well. They ought to have been the happiest years of both our lives. If they weren't, he had no one but himself to thank. Oh, he was just a maddening man, simply maddening. He just set himself to get old and silent and swampy, just sank into himself. He could have looked years younger if he'd taken the trouble. He needn't have walked with a stoop. I'm sure I warned him about that often enough. He was the most miserable host. Whenever we gave a party, everything rested on my shoulders. Robert was simply a wet blanket. As I said to him, and if I said it once, I said it 100 times, he hadn't always been like that. There had been a time when he took an interest in all sorts of things, and had been quite ready to make friends. "What on earth is coming over you?" I used to say. But now he just didn't give answer at all. He would sit staring at me with his great big eyes. I came to hate a man with dark eyes. And I know it now, just hating me. That was my reward after all I'd done. Sheer, wicked, senseless hatred. At the very moment when he was a richer man than he ever dreamed of being. As I used to say to him, "Robert, you're simply letting yourself go to seed." The young woman who came to the house, it wasn't my fault that they liked me better than my old bear of a husband, used to laugh at him. I did my duty to the very end. I forced him to take exercise. That was really my chief reason for keeping a great day. I kept on giving parties. I took him for the most wonderful holidays. I saw that he didn't drink too much. Even when things became desperate, I encouraged him to take up his writing again. It couldn't do any harm by then. How could I help it if he did have a nervous breakdown in the end? My conscience is clear. I've done my duty by him, if ever a woman has. So you see why it would be impossible to. And yet, I don't know. I believe I have changed my mind. I'll make him a fair offer, Hilda. I will not meet him if it means just meeting him and no more. But if I'm given a free hand, I'll take charge of him again. I will take up my burden once more. But I must have a free hand. With all the time one would have here, I believe I could make something of him. Somewhere quite to ourselves. Wouldn't that be a good plan? He's not fit to be on his own. Put me in charge of him. He wants firm handling. I know him better than you do. What's that? No, give him to me, do you hear? Don't consult him. Just give him to me. I'm his wife, aren't I? I was only beginning. There's lots of things I still want to do with him. No, listen, Hilda, please. Please. I'm so miserable. I must have someone to do things to. It's simply frightful down there. No one minds about me at all. I can't alter them. It's dreadful to see them all sitting about and not be able to do anything with them. Give him back to me. Why should he have everything his own way? No good for him. It isn't right. It's not fair. I want Robert. What right have you to keep him from me? I hate him. How can I pay him out if you don't let me have him?
The ghost, which had towered up like a dying candle flame, snapped suddenly. A sour, dry smell lingered in the air for a moment, and then there was no ghost to be seen at all. Well, this is the picture of a wife looking around at all kinds of women. How do you feel about this?
I'm here for the ERA.
Equal right.
What about husbands that do things like that? Are they any better?
All right. That's a good question. Let's talk about the whole issue for a moment. What kind of people are we talking about? Lewis uses the picture of a marriage, but what kind of people are we talking about? Or is Lewis talking about? Pardon? All right. People who try to control other people's lives. Can you think of situations where that happens? Other than husbands doing it to wives or wives to husbands?
Parent and child.
Parent-child relationships?
Employer-employee.
Employers, yes. Using, controlling, manipulating employees.
I think it's the kind of relationships where you're in a helping, supposedly in a helping position, the philanthropist and the wayward boy or something like that.
Professors and students.
I was wondering when somebody would get around for that. Teachers, yes, are very, I think, susceptible to this. Especially if you, it's not so likely to happen, I think, in sort of mass teaching situations, but especially where it's It's a, where there's a more personal possibility. Other situations, other...
Counselor, counselee.
Counselors, okay.
You know, psychiatrist, patient, you know, it's a...
Clergy? Would anybody?
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
You wouldn't say that?
No, I'm not any clerical.
I've been thinking of it anyway, though. We are...
Well, wouldn't it be a new situation where somebody has an upper hand to dump it in? If I wanted to, I could manipulate all the people who offer this. That I see, didn't do what I think they have to.
All right, or how about people in the welfare office manipulating? Yesterday morning we had a session. Were any of you at Jody Kretzmann's session yesterday morning? Isn't this the sort of thing that he was talking about? That in the name of service we really create clients? He was talking about creating a dependency relationship. One of her lines here is how Robert simply came to hate her, what she could see. He would sit staring at me with his great big eyes, and I know it now, just hating me. That was my reward after all I'd done. Sheer, wicked, senseless hatred.
It doesn't seem to me that she created a dependency relationship. I don't think he was ever dependent upon her. He was simply resigned to the situation.
I'm just going to say, I wonder what it would be like if we thought of this in terms of the relationship of countries to the activities of the United States, and the way we have felt, this is the reward for our generosity, that they hate us. Panama would be an example maybe of that. Go ahead, what were you going to say?
It's a matter of, I want this person to look good, so I will look good.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole shoe with professors and welfare officers and countries,
mm-hmm.
we want those countries that are in our camp to look good, so the United States will look good.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes a very selfish motive.
There's hardly any doubt, is there? Lewis doesn't leave us in any doubt at all, but the final drive of this woman was really not for his sake. She starts talking about that, doesn't she? I did it all for his sake. But in the end, it becomes clear that she does it really for her own sake. Yeah, that's what you're talking about.
I think it shows, too, rationalization, that it's obvious to us that the things that she did him no good at all.
Mm-hmm.
But to her, it was all rationalized out perfectly that she was right in every instance.
Mm-hmm. Doing it for his good, insisting that he work harder so he get a promotion, so that he could get more money, so that they could have a bigger house, so that they could spend long hours looking for that house, to have a place to entertain, but not really entertain the kind of people which gave them pleasure. Instead of, in a sense, letting him live his life with a simpler set of circumstances, but that would, in a sense, have made him a richer person to be with, more enjoyable to be with. Yeah. One of the questions I've been asking is, what has to be given up here? Lewis's point is there is no participation in heaven without giving something up. What has to be given up in this case?
No.
Her will. Her image of what he should be.
Her image of what he should be. That's what you meant when you talked about the self had to be given
up? No, I think she has to give up her desires and look for what he wants part of the time. It should have gone marriage and heaven.
They should have gone to marriage.
She didn't hear a thing he said, and she didn't want to.
She didn't want to, huh?
I don't know if anybody else thinks this or not, but I think it's true that she wanted the house and the clothes and all that. I think that becomes clear. But I think also what she really wanted was for him to be eternally indebted to her, to be grateful to her. We were talking the other day about that sense of obliging.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like And what she really wanted from him was to just really recognize that she was empowered, you know, in his life, in a thankful sense.
Let me come back to the marriage encounter thing for a moment. Does this reveal, this incident, that we often marry not a person, but our idea of a person? And and then try to refashion the person we have married into the idea that we have married instead. Pardon?
What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that? I think it's probably even more tragic when we make our children over into what we want them to be instead of letting them experience the freedom of their own personal being. Well, Lewis is, I think, again confronting us with some very difficult questions here.
The other aspect too is this business of affirming him and what he wanted to do and his instincts, his friends, his writing. And I wonder if, you know, it seems to me that where that happens in human relationships, that there are really some good things that happen. Now maybe there is enough old Adam and all of us that we need that corrective also, but normally it seems to me when I see, you know, people affirming one another in what they really would like to do, mm-hmm. there's some very, very fine good things that come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Which of course we never would have known because she
does any blame for this situation attach to the husband, to Robert? We're led in some sense to be very sympathetic to him, aren't we?
What was his problem that he let her do it?
What would you have said to him if you had him here?
Well, the surgical procedure called the backbone installed.
He needed backbone. Yes.
Can't hear. What was the response?
Her response was he needed a surgical procedure to have a backbone installed.
One thing that bothers me here is that, little negative thing, is the saying is, behind every successful man is a woman. You know, he might have needed these shifts. He might never be promoted. He might never been a executive. And we need executives. So if it wasn't for the woman, maybe we'd be short executives.
But the point is, you're a writer. The point is, she married somebody, as I see it happening, she married somebody who is, there's something there to she likes. She starts weeding out of him any initiative.
His creativity, his writing.
But, you know, the comment in there, he only wanted to work 13-hour days. I mean, if I were married, my husband would say, push it to the point of exhaustion, I would say, out, buddy. And I think that's the point, that there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with the encouraging kick in the butt, but she kept kicking.
Mm-hmm. But what about the responsibility for someone you care about, of looking at alternatives? And they don't. It's one thing, perhaps, to point out alternatives, like being successful in certain descriptions. Of course, it's another thing to want the success because that will make the other person mm-hmm. look good. Mm-hmm. But I think the same way is true with children, is it not? Sometimes they don't have the full range of reality, the consequences of. You know, if mm-hmm. your daughter's going to run on the railroad tracks, you'll slap her behind when the train's coming.
That's, I think, what you were trying to say, Dave, wasn't it? That that not all of the options that are open to us are perhaps options which ought to be pursued, but that sometimes a corrective is needed. Is that the case in the description that Lewis is giving us here?
I think that the story goes beyond that. This wife goes beyond looking at options or correcting. But to say to the person you have a relationship with, behave randomly, that's a good thing. Just random behavior. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily particular.
Yeah.
This one line in here that really speaks to her needs, though, about how miserable she was because she needed somebody to do things to, not for, but to. I think that really reveals a lot about her.
I need somebody to do things to, yeah.
But I don't think that too is too wise a choice of language. It makes his point too obvious. He's hitting it.
You think most of us who do things to people don't put it that way. We are always doing them for them.
Well, there's no finesse in using the word too, but it's too obvious.
I don't think we are often aware that enough about what we're doing to other people so that too should be used.
Yeah, I think that it comes, Paul, at the point where she's getting very desperate, where the possibility of a look at herself is becoming very close.
Maybe this is her confession. She finally recognizes what she's been, but then of course that should be her salvation if that's her confession.
Oh, except that she isn't confessing in a way to give it up, she's confessing it in a way to get it back. And so that's precisely the opposite, in a sense, of a confession. Well,
she's like playing God, but she's being a good and a loving God. She's playing God to somebody. But not in the same way that God allows us freedom to make choices.
What do you call a malevolent God? Isn't that precisely a demon? I want to.
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
One of the things I draw from this is we have to be very careful and examine our motives when we're trying to help somebody. Why? Out of love for them, or out of trying to make ourselves look good in other people's eyes or God's eyes or something. And it's a very sort of a trappy situation, very easy to get into a trap.
And maybe the major question again, at least a related one out of the session yesterday morning, is what does it mean to love someone or to serve them? It may not mean doing things either to them or for them. It may mean just sort of letting them alone, letting them muddle along, letting them find their own way, even if we can see ahead and would like to prevent certain problems from arising.
Or even very large things. Why do we want to help the hungry people of the world? Or why do we want to help the ecology? Why?
Pursue that a little bit.
Well, maybe the best thing to do is not to help the ecology. Or maybe the best thing is to not give people food, because then they might grow their own and learn how to grow their own. And that gives them incentive. It's possible, I'm not saying. But one should look carefully behind all your good deeds. Or what you think. Whenever you think you're doing a good deed, be careful.
Get on the bandwagon.
Get on one or get off one?
Well, that's why. Seems to me sometimes, save the whale. I saw in the office the other day, he has a big rubber stamp made. Every piece of mail he sends out, puts his rubber stamp with a couple of whales on it.
And I think he just wants to go along with the thing that's happening today. I don't know whether he's really concerned about the whales or not. You see, maybe that's what he was saying. He's going to get on the bandwagon, or are you doing it really for some good? You really believe in it? For that thing that's going on today?
I would not feel comfortable about it. You are making your choices to lose the motor. You made.
Oh, no, I'm not. I just wondered.
Okay.
Yeah. Like whether you're helping or not, you know. Are you really helping, or are you doing it for another reason? I'm not judging.
The only person who knows that really is the individual. Because I can make assumptions, about what Gretchen does and why Gretchen does it. But there's a high probability, I'd say 60 to 80%, I could be, explicitly wrong about what I'm holding.
You can make assumptions, but you got to check them out before you think they're fact. You're waiting for them to fact. Yeah, I think something of that that Kathy was talking about here. it's sort of like this whole thing where her assumptions or go back to the whole idea of her ideas and his ideas. She made some assumptions. She didn't even bother to think of what Robert wanted, did she? I mean, it wasn't to that point. This was just, she made them without any feedback.
Mm-hmm.
I guess playing God is better than playing demon.
Please.
Talking about the husband again, I have a question, and somebody said, well, he should have called back for him. I've said that myself. You know, if a man's henpecked, well, it's his own fault. He shouldn't let himself be henpecked. But he made it to heaven, didn't he, according to your book? Is he the blessed meek and the blessed peacemaker?
Good point. All right. I'd like to see if we couldn't at least get one or two other things read here, sort of to tie the book together. One place is page 98, and another one 120. Let's start with 98. Very bottom of the page. I'm off, said the ghost. Thanks for all your hospitality, but it's no good, you see. I told this little chap here, he indicated a lizard that was, maybe we ought to start a little bit further back. I saw coming towards us, middle of 98, I saw coming towards us a ghost who carried something on his shoulder. Like all the ghosts, he was unsubstantial, but they differed from one another as smokes differ. Some had been whitish, this one was dark and oily. What sat on his shoulder was a little red lizard, and it was twitching its tail like a whip, whispering things in his ear. As we caught sight of him, he turned his head to the reptile with a snarl of impatience. Shut up, I tell you, he said. It wagged its tail and continued to whisper to him. He ceased snarling and presently began to smile. Then he turned and started to limp westward away from the mountains. Off so soon, said a voice. The speaker was more or less human in shape, but larger than a man, and so bright that I could hardly look at him. His presence smote on my eyes and on my body too, for there was heat coming from him as well as light, like the morning sun at the beginning of a tyrannous summer day. Yes, I'm off, said the ghost. Thanks for all your hospitality, but it's no good, you see. I told this little chap, here he indicated the lizard, that he'd have to be quiet if he came, which he insisted on doing. Of course, his stuff won't do here, I realize that, but he won't stop. I shall just have to go home. Would you like me to make him quiet? Said the flaming spirit, an angel as I now understood. Of course I would, said the ghost. Then I will kill him, said the angel, taking a step backward. Look out! You're burning me! Keep away! Said the ghost, retreating. Don't you want him killed? But you didn't say anything about killing him at first. I hardly meant to bother you with anything so drastic as that. It's the only way, said the angel, whose burning hands were now very close to the lizard. Shall I kill it? Well, that's a further consideration. I'm quite open to consider it, but it's a new point, isn't it? I mean, for the moment, I was only thinking about silencing it because up here, well, it's so damned embarrassing. May I kill it? Well, there's time to discuss that later. There is no time. May I kill it? Please, I never meant to be such a nuisance. Please, really, don't bother. Look, it's gone to sleep of its own accord. I'm sure it'll be all right now. Thanks ever so much. May I kill it? Honestly, I don't think there's the slightest necessity for that. I'm sure I shall be able to keep it in order now. I think the gradual process would be far better than killing it. The gradual process is of no use at all. Don't you think so? Well, I'll think over what you've said very carefully. Honestly, I will. In fact, I'll let you kill it right now. But as a matter of fact, I'm not feeling frightfully well today. It would be silly to do it now. I'd need to be in good health for the operation. Some other day, perhaps. There is no other day. All days are present now. Get back! You're burning me. How can I tell you to kill it? You'd kill me if you did. It is not so. Why, you're hurting me now. I never said it wouldn't hurt you. I said I wouldn't kill you. Oh, I know. You think I'm a coward, but it isn't that. Really, it isn't. I say, let me run back by tonight's bus and get an opinion from my own doctor. I'll come again at the first moment I can. This moment contains all moments. Why are you torturing me? You're jeering at me. How can I let you tear me to pieces? If you wanted to help me, why didn't you kill the damn thing without asking me before I knew? It would be all over by now if you had. I cannot kill it against your will. It is impossible. Have I your permission? The angel's hands were almost closed on the lizard, but not quite. Then the lizard began chatting to the ghost so loud that even I could hear what it was saying. Be careful, it said. He can do what he says. He can kill me. One fatal word from you and he will. Then you'll be without me forever and ever. It's not natural. How could you live? You'd be only sort of a ghost, not a real man as you are now. He doesn't understand. He's a cold, bloodless, abstract thing. It may be natural for him, but it isn't for us. Yes, yes, I know there are no real pleasures now, only dreams. But aren't they better than nothing? And I'll be so good. I admit I've sometimes gone too far in the past, but I promise I won't do it again. I'll give you nothing but really nice dreams, all sweet and fresh and almost innocent. You might say quite innocent. Have I your permission? Said the angel to the ghost. I know it will kill me. It won't, but supposing it did. You're right. It would be better dead than to live with this creature. Then may I? Damn and blast you, go on. Can't you get it over? Do what you like, bellowed the ghost, but ended whimpering, God help me, God help me. Next moment the ghost gave a scream of agony, such as I never heard on earth. The burning one closed his crimson grip on the reptile, twisted it while it bit and writhed, and then flung it, broken-backed, on the turf. Oh, that's done for me, gasped the ghost, reeling backwards. For a moment I could make out nothing distinctly, and then I saw between me and the nearest bush, unmistakably solid but growing every moment solider, the upper arm and shoulder of a man, then brighter still and stronger, the legs and hands, the neck and golden head materialized while I watched, and if my attention had not wavered, I should have seen the actual completing of a man, an immense man, naked, not much smaller than the angel. What distracted me was the fact that at the same moment something seemed to be happening to the lizard. At first I thought the operation had failed. So far from dying, the creature was still struggling, even growing bigger as it struggled. And as it grew, it changed. Its hinder parts grew rounder. The tail, still flickering, became a tail of hair that flickered between huge, glossy buttocks. Suddenly I stood back, rubbing my eyes. What stood before me was the greatest stallion I had ever seen. Silvery white, but with mane and tail of gold. It was smooth and shining, rippled with swells of flesh and muscle, whinnying and stamping with its hoofs. And at each stamp, the land shook. The trees dindled, and the new-made man turned and clapped the new horse's neck. It nosed his bright body. Horse and master breathed each into the other's nostrils. The man turned from it, flung himself at the feet of the burning one, embraced them. When he rose, I thought his face shone with tears, but it may have only been liquid love and brightness which flowed from him. I had not long to think about it. In joyous haste, the young man leaped upon the horse's back. Turning in his seat, he waved farewell and nudged the stallion with his heels. They were off before I well knew what was happening. There was riding, if you like. I came out as quickly as I could from among the bushes to follow them with my eyes, but they were already shooting like a shooting star far off on the green plain, and soon among the foothills of the mountains. Well, on page 104, MacDonald says, "Do you understand all this, my son?" "I don't know about all, sir. Am I right in thinking the lizard really turned into a horse?" "Aye, but it was killed first. You'll not forget that part of the story." "I'll try not to, sir. But does it mean that everything that is in us can go on to the mountains?" "Nothing, not even the best and noblest, can go as it now is. Nothing, not even what is lowest and most bestial, will not be raised again if it submits to death. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. Flesh and blood cannot come to the mountains, not because they are too rank, but because they are too weak. What is a lizard compared with a stallion? Lust is a poor, weak, whispering thing compared with that richness and energy of desire which will arise when lust has been killed. But am I to tell them at home that this man's sensuality proved less an obstacle than the poor woman's love for her son?" That was in an earlier part of the chapter. "For that was at any rate an excess of love." "Ye'll tell them no such thing," replied my teacher sternly. "Excess of love, did ye say? There was no excess. There was a defect. She loved her son too little, not too much. If she had loved him more, there'd be no difficulty. I do not know how her affair will end, but it may well be that at this moment she's demanding to have him down with her in hell. That kind is sometimes perfectly ready to plunge the soul they say they love into endless misery, if only they can still in some fashion possess it. No, you must draw another lesson. You must ask if the risen body, even of appetite, is as grand a horse as he saw, what would the risen body of maternal love or friendship be?" The last part of the book, page 120, let's just turn to that for a few moments yet. He had just finished a dialogue in which a person tried to use pity as a weapon to force compliance. And Lewis comments on that now. "Is it really tolerable," he asks at the top, "that she should be untouched by his misery, even his self-made misery? Would ye rather he still had the power of tormenting her? He did it many a day and many a year in their earthly life." "Well, no, I suppose I don't want that." "What then?" "I hardly know, sir. What some people say on earth is that the final loss of one soul gives the lie to all the joy of those who are saved. Ye see that it does not. I feel in a way, though, that it ought to." "That sounds very merciful, but see what lurks behind it." "What?" "Well, the demand of the loveless and the self-imprisoned that they should be allowed to blackmail the universe, that till they consent to be happy on their terms, no one else shall taste joy, that there should be the final power, that hell should be able to veto heaven. Oh, I don't know what I want, sir. Son, it must be one way or the other. Either the day must come when joy prevails and all the makers of misery are no longer able to infect it, or else forever and ever the makers of misery can destroy in others the happiness they reject for themselves. I know it has a grand sound to say you'll accept no salvation which leaves even one creature in the dark outside, but watch that sophistry, or you'll make a dog in a manger the tyrant of the universe. But dare one say, it is horrible to say, that pity must ever die? You must distinguish. The action of pity will live forever, but the passion of pity will not. The passion of pity, the pity we merely suffer, the ache that draws men to concede what they what should not be conceited, and to flatter when they should speak the truth. The pity that has cheated many a woman out of her virginity and many a statesman out of his honesty, that will die. It was used as a weapon by bad men against good ones. Their weapon will be broken. And what is the other kind, the action? It is a weapon on the other side. It leaps quicker than light from the highest place to the lowest to bring healing and joy, whatever the cost to itself. It changes darkness into light and evil into good, but it will not, at the cunning tears of hell, impose on good the tyranny of evil. Every disease that submits to a cure shall be cured, but we will not call blue yellow to please those who insist on still having jaundice, nor make a manure pile out of the world's garden for the sake of some who cannot abide the smell of roses. You say it will go down to the lowest, sir, but she didn't go down with him to hell. She didn't even see him off by the bus. And where would ye have had her go? Well, where we came, by that bus, the big gulf beyond the edge of the cliff over there. You can't see it from here, but you must know the place I mean. My teacher gave a curious smile. Look, he said, and with a word he went down on his hands and knees. I did the same, how it hurt my knees, and presently saw that he had plucked a blade of grass. Using its thin edge as a pointer, he made me see, after I had looked very closely, a crack in the soil so small I could not have identified it without this aid. I cannot be certain, he said, that this is the crack ye came up through, but through a crack no bigger than that ye certainly came. But, I gasped with a feeling of bewilderment not unlike terror, I saw an infinite abyss and cliffs towering up and up, and then this country on top of the cliffs. Aye, but the voyage was not mere locomotion. That bus and all of you inside it were increasing in size. Do you mean then that hell, all that infinite empty town, is down in some little crack like this? Yes, all hell is smaller than one pebble of your earthly world, but it is smaller than one atom of this world, the real world. Look at yon butterfly. If it swallowed all hell, hell would not be big enough to do it any harm, or to have any taste. It seems big enough when you're in it, sir. And yet, all loneliness, angers, hatreds, envies, and itchings that it contains, if rolled into one single experience and put into the scale against the least moment of joy that is felt by the least in heaven, would have no weight that could be registered at all. Bad cannot succeed even in being bad, as truly as good is good. If all hell's miseries together entered the consciousness of yon wee yellow bird on the bough there, they would be swallowed up without a trace, as one great drop of ink has been dropped into the ocean, to which your terrestrial Pacific would be only a molecule. I see, I said at last, she couldn't fit into hell. He nodded. There's not room for her. Hell could not open its mouth wide enough. And she couldn't make herself smaller, like Alice, you know? Nothing like small enough. For a damned soul is nearly nothing. It is shrunk, shut up in itself. Well, we haven't got time to finish this. Lewis wakes at the end as if from a dream to tell us, in a sense, that he's not trying to describe this as if it were a literal description. But what he is trying to do, I think, is to confront us once again with the question. He says, Lewis's point is that heaven is reality itself. Hell is illusion. It looks as if we are choosing realities when we live with our idols or our defenses or our wishes. We may really not be living with the truth at all. We may only be living with illusion. In one sense, at least, the story of the killing of the lizard was a commentary on some of the things that I said this morning, especially on this passage from Luke about no one entering the kingdom of heaven without violence. Our illusions have to die in order for us to experience the kingdom of God. But that's frequently what we insist on keeping at all costs. We don't really want the truth. We would rather have our illusions. We don't want God. We would rather have our idols. And that, Lewis is saying here in the book, is a price that says Lewis, is a price which will keep us finally from God and from heaven. Well, I think this is, in a sense, one of Lewis's most dramatic books, full of an attempt to speak to us by using images, by using an elaborate set of symbols, but I think one that nevertheless makes its point pretty well.